Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks. We are continuing conversations about zoning bills up for discussion in Hartford. In fact, there are four bills proposed in committees right now dealing with new statewide zoning rules and affordable housing mandates in our towns. And while there are a lot of people who are behind aspects of these, I won't say all, but there are aspects that people are behind, there are many people who feel that their voices aren't being brought to the table and that these just don't make sense. These one-size-fits-all zoning bills. And we have talked extensively to Alexis Harrison, who is a member of the Fairfield Town Plan and Zoning Commission, but also more than that is just a concerned citizen living in Fairfield County and has been motivated to really speak out about these statewide zoning bills in the last year, and has actually been part of a big group as well, a grassroots group that has talked about this, advocated for it. They rallied last week in Stamford, and they're expected to rally next week in Southport, and Alexis is back this morning with all the details. Good morning, Alexis. Thank you so much for popping back on. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Melissa. Great to be back. Thank you so much.
So I was away last week. How did it go in Stamford? What did you accomplish?
It's great. Yeah, we had, you know, several dozen people come down to the Stamford train station on a gorgeous early spring day on Saturday. And, you know, it really allowed us, we the people, you know, the citizens of you know, Connecticut, to assert our voices about what we believe are bad zoning policies that really dilute the voice of the people and really the zoning commissions that we really rely on to make smart decisions for our local communities.
And you have another rally set for next week, I believe April 14th?
That's right. We're going to be rallying in Southport, Connecticut on the 14th, and we're also going to be doing one in Old Greenwich this Friday from 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. And we're focused, you know, doing these around the train stations because, you know, as we've talked about before, there is this transit-oriented bill out there. It's actually died in committee, but, you know, we're remaining vigilant. That would allow as-of-right development around train stations. And as-of-right means that means the voice of the people is gone. It would just be rubber stamped by a zoning official. So there would be no public hearing. You know, people could not weigh in on this. And we just feel that's really troubling, you know, for our local communities. And I think all people should be really concerned about that.
So we're going to dive into the four bills that are being debated right now in Hartford. But before we do that, I wanted to know the goal of going to these train stations. Like you said, it really brings perspective when you are rallying at the train stations and you could see proximity to, oh, OK, this is what they mean. Like you can kind of envision what these bills look like if they were to be passed into law. Do you find that the people going to the rally, Alexis, are they aware of what these bills really mean, or do you find that they're learning kind of for the first time? And I ask that only because this is what I find troubling, regardless of people's political backgrounds or which side that they're on. I find that a lot of times people have no idea in local politics what's actually going on in their own state. And are these people who already support what you guys stand for, or are they learning for the first time what these bills could really mean to their communities?
Yeah, that's a great point. And we know people are busy, you know, working, you know, raising their families, mm-hmm. and they don't always have the time to, you know, focus on what's going on in Hartford. And we really rely on our legislators to provide information on these bills. But unfortunately, that doesn't always happen. You know, a lot of people are coming from neighborhood groups who are now beginning to understand the implications of these bills. I think this year I have seen more of an awakening with people on the impact of these policies. Versus last year when they kind of came to the forefront. You know, it was during COVID and people were just, you know, just not really focused as much. But I am seeing, you know, people kind of waking up, which is a great thing. You know, we need to assert our voices. You know, I really believe the government works for us. Mm. And if they're putting forth bad policies, we need to tell them that.
We're talking this morning to Alexis Harrison, and she is a member of the Fairfield Town Plan and Zoning Commission. but also, she is part of a major grassroots. Remind folks what the name of your group is called.
Yeah, CT169 Strong, and we have a website, CT169strong.org. And we're just a group of regular citizens who are concerned about the future of our state and having a top-down, one-size-fits-all approach to zoning. Mm-hmm. Zoning impacts everybody. And, you know, I was moved to actually run for zoning because I believe the voice of environmentalists, of you know, allowing us to be good stewards of our town, you know, these commissions really allow us to do that, which is why I've been motivated to be part of this movement. And we're not paid. We're not, you know, lobbyists. We're just, you know, regular folk kind of doing our due diligence on behalf of our neighbors.
It's amazing, Alexis, because I do find that this group of people, CT 169 Strong, I do find that there's been quite the shift in the storytelling of I think how you guys have been characterized, if you don't mind me saying it that way, because mm-hmm. I remember when the zoning bills came up over a year ago, and immediately, whether it was the media or it was one side of the aisle saying, you know, these are people who are rich and they just don't want, you know, people moving into our neighborhoods and like don't believe what they're saying with the environment and so on. So they just don't want minorities. And I remember that being the beginning, like shots fired at your group. And it's amazing how that has really, to me, progressed to now where you had the governor just a couple weeks ago here on the show say, yeah, I mean, when you hear what these bills look like, I don't agree with them. I mean, that's a very different tone in over a year. And it's something that you guys should be very proud of. I think you've even gotten people from the other side to go, well, maybe these are a little broken. Maybe it's not actually going to do what we needed to do for our residents, because I think even your group agrees we need more affordable housing. I don't think anyone disagrees with that. We need more options. But what is being proposed right now?
No, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, it really, I found it really disconcerting that the narrative was really brought down to the point of, you know, sometimes we were actually called racist.
Yes,
and
I remember.
I don't want to be part of anything that, you know, would be in that direction ever. And I think most people in Connecticut are that way. So we really need to talk about what's in the bills. And I think the media has not done a great job of talking about what's in the bills. They don't really create affordability. And as we've talked about before, affordability also starts with a lot of different factors, not just housing. And I agree that we do need housing. We need diversity of housing in Connecticut. There is no question. But these bills do not create that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's not part of the equation when we're having that broader conversation in the media and elsewhere.
We're talking about four bills proposed in committees that deal with new statewide zoning rules and affordable housing mandates in our towns across Connecticut. So, Alexis, you have the floor. Tell us these four bills. Explain what they are so people really understand what it would mean for them.
Yeah, and, you know, excuse me, so the HB 5429, and that's the TOD bill that we were talking about, and that imposes mandatory as-of-right zoning of 15 units per acre around our train stations, which is quite a bit. And we all know, I mean, most of our towns in around the center of town near the train stations are very old. They're historical. There's a lot of older infrastructure. So this would be a very, you know, I think, hard possibility to create housing in around these train stations. And again, as-of-right removes the voice of the people of the commission. And then there's also this other bill, HB 5204, which is, I call it the fair share bill. And this would require towns to, in many cases, double their housing stock. It's a very vague bill, and it would require a formula to come up, and which would determine our housing quota. But that quota, that calculation, would not come to fruition until after the bill is passed. And a group in Hartford would be determining this formula, not people that you've elected.
We're
really concerned about that.
Yeah, that's a huge concern. And the reason I say that is because very similarly, correct me if I'm wrong, but we saw, for example, Fairfield and Milford, just to throw their names out there. That was one of the big concerns with like the marijuana bill. Whether you liked it or you didn't like it, it was based on the number of people who lived there. So if you had more than mm-hmm. 60,000 people, you had to now create designated areas. And I remember having both Mayor Ben Blake and Brenda Kupchick, the first elect woman in Fairfield, both were livid about this. And they spoke to the governor, or they sent, I should say, messages saying, you know, that's not what we do here. I mean, listen, if you want to pass something, that's, you know, that's what you want to do. But why should we have to be subjected to create areas where people can smoke marijuana freely? And, you know, you look at Fairfield, for example, where you've got multiple major universities, over mm-hmm. a dozen schools. I mean, it was a beach community, and I just remember that Without having those parameters in place, that to me is very unfinished business to vote on. That would be very irresponsible, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is troubling. And again, I don't know, in Fairfield or any other town would be able to double their housing stock. I mean, that would be significant.
And
we already do have an affordable housing law. I think you're familiar with it, 830G. And that mandates towns to have 10% of their housing stock deemed affordable.
Correct, yep.
And in Fairfield, for example, that would require us to have about 2,000 more units. And honestly, I'm on the Zoning Commission now. That's a very hard possibility as well, because we don't have that infrastructure. We don't have the room. We don't have the roads to accommodate more and more people. So it's really about, the towns deciding what is best and based on our infrastructure, mm-hmm. Not the state. And I believe that the 830G law has to be addressed as well and amended or repealed before adding more burdens to our towns. Mm-hmm. Because that fair share bill I was just talking about, if we don't meet those mandates of the housing units, then we could get sued. I mean, there'll be a lot of punitive actions from the state. So I just see this as something burdening our local towns even more.
Mm. Alexis Harrison is here, and we're talking about the zoning bills that are being debated in Hartford right now. And, I think the other part of this, Alexis, I know you have a couple more bills to talk about, so I'm going to keep this short. But the other thing that I find very concerning is I keep feeling like more and more the voices of your local town and city residents and even the leaders, like your mayors, your first selectmen or women, I feel like they're being eliminated. I find that's one of the most troubling parts of any of these bills is the fact that it just feels like you don't really have a leg to stand on. You're a taxpayer. You're living in the town. You're paying for, to live there. But your voice is really kind of going to go away, essentially, if these were to
right.
become law.
Yeah. And even in the formation of the drafting of these bills, they're being, pushed and crafted by housing activists. And it comes from a very good and laudable place, I believe. But the problem is not all the stakeholders are at the table when we're even creating this legislation. Not the environmentalists, preservationists, engineers, people in the finance industry, people who would have a really important expertise to bring to the table were negated from this whole conversation, which is troubling to me.
Interesting.
I just want to hit on one more bill, HB 5209, and this is an act concerning a housing authority jurisdiction. So this would allow another housing authority to come into your town and build. So if I'm in Fairfield, the Bridgeport Housing Authority could come into Fairfield and have jurisdiction. So again, that's troubling.
That just seems bizarre to me. Is it because they would run out of room or something? I mean, obviously you're just making up an example, but why would that even be something? That just seems messy to me.
It does. And honestly, it's very hard to understand or pinpoint the motivation of this bill. But this was voted out of the Housing Committee. So the entire General Assembly will be voting on it. Another town having, a say in another town's, mm-hmm. building, zoning, whatever, is very troubling. And people really need to be alert and call their legislators.
Mm-hmm. What are the chances at this point, Alexis? It is a short session. A lot of these bills died last year, but they were mm-hmm. resurrected when they weren't supposed to be, or at least we were told they weren't going to be. What are the chances that these pass this session?
I don't really know. And, I think what's maybe in our favor is perhaps given that these bills have not been fully vetted, perhaps in an election year, maybe folks, legislators will maybe pause a bit and say, this is, let's just hold on this and reconvene next year. Which I think is probably the best idea. We're in a short session, as you said. These bills have not been fully vetted or really studied very well. And I believe we just need more time and bring all the stakeholders at the table. That's all we're asking. We're not saying no. Just bring everybody to the table. That's democracy. That's fair.
Right. Let's have an open conversation about this. Alexis Harrison, again, with your website, it's CT169strong. Is it .org or .com? Sorry.
.org, yeah.
.org.
CT169strong.org. Yeah, I appreciate your attention to this big issue. Thank you, Melissa.
Absolutely. And we appreciate you coming on, Alexis Harrison. And a reminder to folks, if you want to go to the next rally, it is happening next week. It's on April 14th at the Southport train station, and it's happening in the afternoon. So be sure to go check that out. And again, CT 169 169strong.org. Thanks, Alexis. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Once a month, we get to check in with the American Red Cross. The Connecticut chapter in this morning is no different. We're checking in with John Godin of the Red Cross. Good morning, John. Thank you so much for being back on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well, Melissa, and thank you for having us. We appreciate it.
Yes, of course. April is National Volunteer Month, so it's perfect timing to chat with you guys. It's actually National Volunteer Week. We're coming up on that, which is specifically April 17th to the 23rd. Tell me, how many people does the American Red Cross recognize for giving their time and for helping out?
Well, we have, in Connecticut alone, we have over 2,000 people volunteer for the Red Cross in this state. And what people don't realize, and I always emphasize this, 90% of the staffing for the Red Cross is through volunteers. So it's important that we recognize all of their efforts, that these are people who are giving their time and energy to a terrific cause.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. I mean, what are some of the things that your volunteers are tasked with?
Well, for instance, we have disaster volunteers daily that respond to, on average, 2 home fires a day, which people don't realize that. You may hear of a fire that happens anywhere throughout the state. Typically, the Red Cross is there providing the needs of the family who leaves their homes. Also, throughout the entire year, we train over 45,000 people throughout the state in first aid, CPR, water safety. And from a blood donation standpoint, on average, we collect about 129,000 donations of blood, blood products, and platelets across 62,500 individual donors. It's a pretty big enterprise, and it wouldn't happen without those volunteers.
It's so true, because you think about the donors, you know, when I think Red Cross, you immediately think about the donors. But you're right, to run those events, to be there, to respond to disasters, like you said, support the collection of blood. It takes people to do that. You need bodies to do that.
Absolutely. If you think of the folks who respond to fires, so picture an individual who's what is called a on-call duty officer. Let's say there's a fire in Waterbury at midnight. These are individuals that are on call and respond in the middle of the night. They're not getting paid for this. They're volunteering for this activity. And you really, for those who are impacted by a house fire, you really rely on those individuals to be the first point of contact after first responders. It's really an amazing thing that we do.
Mm-hmm. We're talking this morning to John Godin of the American Red Cross, the Connecticut chapter. And, you know, John, the last time you and I connected on the show, we were talking about the extreme need for blood, that we were at record lows for donations across the country and including, of course, here in Connecticut. I would imagine that sort of has a trickle effect. I mean, are you guys relying on more people to step up and volunteer for the Red Cross as well?
Yeah, we always have a need, and right now one of our appeals is more volunteers in the blood donation area. For instance, we have a critical need for blood donor ambassadors. These are individuals that are the first smile you see when you walk in to give blood. They check you in, they coordinate you moving to a collection area, and they also give you the snacks after you complete the blood donation.
Love those
guys.
We
really have a need for... Yeah, we really have a need for those folks. And all you need is compassion. You need a smile. You need, you know, kind of the customer service skills and wanting to really do good stuff from a humanitarian standpoint. And the second need, Melissa, that we have are individuals who actually are tasked with bringing the blood from our Farmington kind of production collection area to hospitals around the region where those blood donations are needed. So if you live in the Farmington area and have an interest in doing something like that, that's another need that we have. These are individuals who may be delivering blood in the middle of the night, early morning, late evening. But if someone needs it in a hospital, we want to make sure we're there to provide the blood product.
Mm-hmm. And so you were saying specifically in like the Farmington area right now is where... Right now, you guys are focused?
That's where our major blood collection area is and where we process the blood. So anyone who has an interest in doing what we call a transportation specialist role, that's where the beginning of the transportation process starts.
I see. But it's if you're somebody who lives in Fairfield or New Haven County, don't mind driving, is that okay to still?
Fine. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. Is there a place where people can go to see a list of volunteer positions open? And what are you required to do to become a volunteer? Because a lot of times, too, John, and this might be a common misconception, people think you have to work in the medical field to work for American Red Cross or volunteer for them, I should say.
Yeah, no, you don't have to be. Obviously, we welcome folks with medical backgrounds, but I don't have a medical background. And they certainly love having me as a volunteer. And the process is fairly simple. You go on redcross.org, volunteer. You can look up all of the different positions. You can put in an application through that site. And what ends up happening is you get a call from a volunteer engagement coordinator, and they will kind of interview you based on what your skills are. And then from there, they will do a background check of you, and then you get kind of onboarded into the Red Cross family. Based on the type of stuff that you do within the Red Cross, you'll have specific trainings or what we call gaps in education that you need to fill in order to be a Red Cross volunteer in that specialty. And if you desire to take leadership roles in the Red Cross, you could then take additional training to maybe coordinate volunteers or run a staff of volunteers, or in a major disaster, get deployed. Mm-hmm. But the good part is you get to work for a terrific organization, you get all sorts of terrific training, and it's a family. And I think for those who have the time and inclination to work on humanitarian type efforts, it really is a good organization to embrace and volunteer for.
Mm. We're chatting this morning with John Godin of the American Red Cross Connecticut chapter. And April, if you weren't aware, April is actually a very important month for the American Red Cross. It is National Volunteer Month. And the Red Cross says it is critically important that they're able to maintain a readily available blood supply for patients. And it sounds like, John, you guys are celebrating volunteer donors who are really the only source of blood, platelets, and plasma for those in need. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. I think you've probably heard me quote this before. Every 2 seconds, someone in America needs blood. There are 2.5 million people that generously donate blood through the Red Cross system. And that accounts for roughly 12,500 regular blood donations and 6,000 platelet donations each day.
Wow.
The reality is we need volunteers to help process that as well, because you have paid staff that does the actual blood collection itself, but you need volunteer staff to help coordinate donors as they come in. And you need volunteer staff to transport that blood from one location to the location where the blood is needed. That's a pretty big undertaking. You're talking very big numbers, 2.5 million people process a year. That would not happen without the generosity of our volunteers. And in April, we make it a special moment for them in recognition for their hard work and commitment to the mission. So that's why it's so important to us. And also to reinforce the need for new volunteers who embrace the Red Cross mission and really want to do some terrific things for their communities.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. You don't think about the behind the scenes. Again, we talked about this, but you think about the people who are donating, which, listen, we would be nowhere without our blood donors, but the people who then have to process and kind of crunch the numbers and see where we're at is very obviously incredibly important. And I'm curious, John, do you mind giving us an update? Where are we at as a nation? As I mentioned, the last few months, I feel like we've been at critical numbers where we maybe could fill. I think I remember you saying something like 3 or 4 days where we felt solid in our numbers, which is not great. So are we getting any better? Are we doing any better?
Well, we still consider the blood supply vulnerable. Mm. But what I will say is the beginning of the year when we had a lot of appeals, and I think I spoke on your show probably in February regarding this, we had a lot of folks that came out and donated blood, and we had a tremendous appeal. I think what's happened is with the pandemic kind of slowing down a little bit, you get more people donating. But it is still in vulnerable supply, which is why we can continually reinforce the message that we want blood donors to come out, if they can give blood, to help keep that supply sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very true. John, what is your website, your number, if people want to learn more about volunteering or donating or want to learn more about the American Red Cross and the work that you do? Where can they go?
You just have to go online on www.redcross.org. You can access any information you need regarding that. If people want to donate blood, they can also access that site. They can call 1-800-RED-CROSS. Or like I explained to a lot of people and really, really promote this, the Red Cross Blood app, the Red Cross app itself, really is a terrific tool for people who operate almost exclusively on their smartphone. And I entertain people to use that app if they're comfortable using it.
Mm-hmm. Well, John Godin, we so appreciate the work that you do, not only for the American Red Cross, but also as a volunteer. I don't know if you caught John saying that earlier in his interview, but he also does volunteer for the Red Cross, which is very cool, and is a spokesperson right here in Connecticut. Thank you so much for the work that you do, John, and we'll talk again next month.
Sounds good, Melissa. You take care, and thank you for the partnership. We appreciate it.
Absolutely. John Godin here on WICC, and interestingly enough, John has been on the phone with us for just about 20 minutes, and so I did some quick math. And again, if you heard John say it before, every 2 seconds, someone in the U.S. needs blood. If it's a patient battling cancer, a car accident victim, a parent experiencing a difficult childbirth, you know, you name it, there are so many people who need blood. So just in this 20-minute conversation, if you do the math, that's 600 people just during this segment who need blood in the U.S., if you can believe that. That's why the need is so great, not just for donors, but also for volunteers. So we thank John and his team at the American Red Cross for coming on each and every month.
It's time to get out and explore.
Melissa in the Morning brings you science you may not know on Southern Connecticut's news and information leader, WICC 600 AM and 107.3 FM.
So it's hard to understand it over radio, but many people will remember from the movie Meet the Robinsons when the T-Rex cannot grab the little boy in the movie, and you hear him say, "Well, what's going on down there?" And he goes, "I got a big head and little arms." And you know, it's funny, years and years go by, and every generation, I think, have asked this question. Why do T-Rexes have the smallest arms known to mankind? I don't know if that's really the truth, but it sure feels that way. So let's tackle it this morning in Science You May Not Know. David Mestre is here. Good morning, David. I could tell you my almost four-year-old will love this topic today.
I know. You know, like everybody loves a good dinosaur story. And,
yeah.
And the T-Rex is actually like one of the wildest ones. I mean, you know, you've got this apex predator. I mean, this is one of the biggest carnivores ever, with a 5-foot head, 6-inch razor sharp teeth, and really little arms.
You got little baby arms. Yeah, it doesn't make any
little
sense.
It's like its head is 5 feet long, and its arms is like barely 3. I mean, and I think that most people don't really kind of understand, why this is so strangely small until you kind of put it into proportion. Let's put it into proportion with a basketball player, 6 foot tall basketball player. And you probably have an idea of what kind of reach a basketball player has. Well, imagine a basketball player that's 6 feet tall with 5-inch arms.
Right. That's what I'm saying. It's just so
ridiculous.
It's so bizarre. Like, you ever go to one of those? I'm sure you have, David, but we started taking Chase to those dinosaur exhibitions that they have, like, up in Hartford sometimes. We've gone maybe 2 or 3 times, and every time we look at the T-Rex, I'm like, they remind me of Basset Hounds. You know, you've got these very long, kind of stocky body, and we had Basset Hounds growing up, but then they got these little baby legs, and it's like, what is going on here? It's
What happened? So one of the things that happened, you know, I mean, we've known about a T-Rex for over a century, you know, so there have been fossils that have been collected of T-Rex, and as they assemble these fossils, this trait really starts to stand out. Mm-hmm. Why does it have such small arms? And so, you know, paleontologists over time, they try to come up with a reason. You know, it has these small arms because maybe it does something with them. You know, maybe it's for signaling. Maybe it has like a special sign language that it uses the arms for. Some ideas were like if it's on the ground, it may use the arms to kind of get itself back up again, or maybe it was to hold the prey or stab its prey, or one even thought like, you know, maybe it uses it to push over a triceratops if it's sleeping at night, you know, kind of like cow tipping or something like that.
Right.
You know,
that
was a thing. They actually thought that. You know,
interesting.
They actually thought that. So why small arms? Well, you know, most paleontologists tried to come up with a reason of how we could have possibly used those small arms. But one paleontologist recently, he's written a paper. He's out at UC Berkeley, Kevin Padian. And Kevin came up with this idea. Said, listen, this has to give a Tyrannosaurus rex a certain advantage, that this trait is passed on and even, you know, augmented and accelerated, like this shrinking of arms. And so one of the things that he thought was that, well, you know, it may be that Tyrannosaurus rex is a pack hunter, so it's probably around a bunch of other T-Rexes. And they all have big, sharp teeth and big heads, and maybe they're feeding all at the same time. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen alligators feed. Like, you know, if you throw a chicken into alligator pen, they are all in a feeding frenzy.
Right. It's over.
So imagine now, not just a beast with a mouth the size of an alligator. You know, we're talking about a beast that has the mouth the size of a T-Rex, which is, you know, this is a 5-foot mouth. You know,
right.
This is a very large.
Literally the same height as my body, yes.
It's literally the same height as your body.
Yes.
And so imagine they're tearing apart. They're not even swallowing things. These teeth aren't for chomping and chewing. And you know, they're just ripping apart things. And if you're stuck there and you've got these long arms, you might accidentally or on purpose.
Oh, no, hurt yourself?
Shoo your friend's arm off, you know?
Oh, that's, wow.
Yeah, and so what happens? So now you got a chewed off arm, and you might get an infection, or you might suffer some heavy bleeding. And now you're a T-Rex that passes away, and when you die, you're not passing on that trait to your descendants. Long arms are bad. And so maybe there's a T-Rex that ended up with a slightly shorter arm, so it's a little out of the way of the other mouths and that are feeding, and then maybe that trait just gives you a little bit of advantage that you can pass that trait on to other T-Rexes in time. You know, so eventually the species starts to evolve, and then the arm just gets shorter and shorter. So that may give you better survival at feeding, so that you're not actually getting your arm chewed off by a bigger T-Rex
that's
at the feeding. The other thought, and this is something what happens in evolutionary biology, is if you have a trait that your descendants aren't really using, you either use that trait or you lose it. And so maybe over time, you know, having arms, the arms just kind of got useless. And we see this with a couple of other predatory dinosaurs, carnivorous dinosaurs, where as the head starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger, these forelimbs, they just get smaller. And because they're not really used to hold the prey down or in hunting grabbing
or
anything. It's a waste. Yeah. It's just like, why do you need this trait? It's not really doing anything for you. Your mouth is doing most of the work.
Right. Anyways. Yeah. That's true.
Yeah.
I think those are great theories. They're definitely better than mine. Always growing up, I thought, well, you have to give other animals some kind of a shot. I mean, if you gave them, I'm like, listen, like there's just no beating a Tyrannosaurus Rex at anything. I mean, maybe the only dinosaur that could give it a shot is like a Spinosaurus. But even so, I was like,
it's
man,
like that Achilles heel.
You got to give them something that makes
it's not perfect.
You can't
have Superman going around there without some kryptonite.
Right, you have to have kryptonite. Come on. Or then it's like, come on. I don't know. Everything would be, we would still have T-Rexes walking the earth and nothing else. Just nothing. Literally nothing. No humans, no nothing. Just T-Rexes, if it were. And that's how I justify why they have some arms.
Thank God for that asteroid.
Oh, God. not. No, my son will not like to hear that, David, so we'll pretend that we didn't say that. David, thank you so much.
You can tell him about those arms.
Yeah.
Tell him about those
arms.
We'll
talk about the arms, though. We'll definitely talk about the arms. David, you are too fun. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again next week.
Take care.
We got big heads and little arms, I'm telling you.